is Gary, and this is I'll Have a Beer and Talk, a show that I make in an undisclosed location somewhere underneath Portland, Oregon, where I tell you about some cool, clever things I read about on the internet over the previous week while I have a delicious craft beer. It's been a crazy past couple of days for me. This time of year is packed with rich foods and lots of booze. And it is tricky for collecting interesting stories. It seems everyone kind of checks out from December 24th all the way through to January 1st, so my usual sources of information had some pretty slim pickings. Hopefully I found some stuff to pique your interest and start the all-new year of 2018 off to a good start. All nude. No, not really. The beer that I have this week, much like last week, was not chosen randomly, but actually I've been saving it for about a year now. I have Brewery Schloss Eggenberg's Sammy Kloss, a 14% ABV Doppelbock. Whatever is a Doppelbock, you might be saying right now. Well, a Bock is a strong German lager, so a Doppelbock is twice that. It's analogous to a double IPA or an Imperial Stout. Take something already hearty and embiggen it. The Sammy Kloss is quite special. Every December 6th, yes, St. Nicholas's Day, the Schloss Eggenberg Brewery brews up a batch of Sammy Kloss, then it's aged for 10 whole months before it's bottled up. The one I have here is from 2015, so this should be quite the taste adventure. Let's ring in the new year by switching to the beer mic and opening her up. Alright, it's a very reddish brown with a little off-white head, and it smells insanely malty, like a bale of hay malty. Let's find out what it tastes like. Wow, that's quite an intense flavor. It is kind of like candy apple dipped in maple syrup. There's definitely the malt smell is not really present in the taste itself, but you can kind of feel it as part of the whole flavor profile. That is really strong. That is a 14% Doppelbock. Not for the weak. That's going to put some hairs on the hairs in your chest. Sadly, the holidays are over. All the fanciful decorations that bring a tiny glimmer of joy to our drab lives come down, and quite a lot of waste is generated. So what should we do with all those Xmas trees? Throw them in a lake? According to Gizmodo, that's exactly what we should be doing. It turns out all those spruce and pine trees can be used to create artificial reefs, well, organic artificial reefs, that aid a lake's aquatic ecosystem. Algae grows on the trees, underwater bugs eat the algae, small fish eat the bugs, and the large fish eat the small fish. It's the circle of life with Xmas trees. Believe it or not, this is pretty common, practiced by many states' wildlife agencies and reservoir managers across the country. For the past 20 years, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers collect thousands of discarded or unused Xmas trees to create fish habitat areas in Carlisle Lake in southern Illinois. They bundle 2 to 3 trees together and attach them to a 25-pound weight so the trees don't float up to the surface and become a boating hazard. The trees last about 3 to 5 years before they fully biodegrade, and even the piles of trees that don't make it into the lake end up being useful. They provide places for rabbits to hide from predators. The Bureau of Land Management in Arizona employs the same idea at Lake Havasu, but instead of a weight, they use biodegradable sandbags to keep the trees sleeping with the fishes. There, they help a variety of sunfish, bluegill, and bass. The Bureau also uses tree branches and palm fronds for the artificial reefs and give landscapers a tax credit at the end of the year if they donate their clippings. It's totally green, it's biodegradable, everything breaks down, so it's good for the environment, said Bureau maintenance worker Robert Stapp. Hooray recycling! Now, don't just go tossing your tree into the nearest lake. Please, please check with your local wildlife agency first. I don't know about you, but I tend to get a little... well, I'll just be honest, fat this time of year. It's a perfect storm of cold weather and lack of sunlight that makes you want to hibernate, and there's the almost nonstop supply of rich foods and boozes available. There can be a benefit to carrying around a few extra pounds, however. According to New Scientist, a little extra fat could help you fight infections. A team of scientists at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, led by Yasmin Belkade, have found that a specific type of immune cell, which is called a memory T cell, is stored in the body fat of mice. They are called memory T cells because they can learn to fight infections. When exposed to a pathogen, they remember it, and the next time they knock heads with it, they mount a stronger immune response. When infecting the mice with parasites or bacteria, it was observed that the memory T cells would cluster in the mice's body fat very, very densely. The cells also seemed to be more effective at dealing with infections than cells stored in other organs, and were better at replicating and releasing chemicals to fight infections. So what does this all mean? It means that fat tissues is not only a reservoir for memory cells, but those memory cells have enhanced function. The tissue is like a magic potion that can optimally activate the T cells, Belkade said. And the memory T cells keep their amazing abilities even after being transplanted. The team made some body fat transfers from mice that had been face down a barrage of infections into mice that had been kept pretty much infection-free. The infection-free mice were then exposed to the same bacteria and parasites the other mice had been exposed to, and the memory T cells in the transplanted fat took up the challenge, giving the mice as much protection as their original host mice. Belkade believes that the fat gives the memory T cells such a power boost because they may be feeding on the energy and nutrient-rich fat tissue. And hey, guess what? The memory T cells are present in the body fat of monkeys, too. That means they might be lurking in human body fat. Anthony Ferrante from Columbia University believes that fat should be considered an immune organ. If you pick up a textbook, it would list the immune organs as the lymph nodes, thymus, but this study and others are changing that, he said. However, more fat doesn't mean more effective immune responses. Just a little bit of fat. As obesity kicks in, the relationship between body fat and the immune system changes, leading to harmful inflammation. But having some fat is actually very healthy. I don't think the small perturbations in fat we experience from having a bit too much goose at Christmas are going to affect our immune system, says Ferrante. But one perhaps can take some solace in the knowledge that good things are going on in our fat while we're eating. Belkade and her team are now looking for immune cells, like our new friend the memory T cells, in human fat tissue. If they do hang out in there, this research could lead to new ways to boost the human immune system's response to vaccinations, infections, and even the big C, cancer. You could take immune cells from a person, make them more aggressive and more able to fight cancer, and then put them back, she says. If they could find a way to deliver these highly trained immune cells in the fat cells of some well-marbled bacon, I think we'll be in a very good place indeed. Have you ever seen one of those weird helium-filled shark balloons that you can pilot around the house? That small dirigible design could allow us to explore inaccessible areas of ancient structures with minimal impact, according to NewAtlas.com. Scientists from France's INRIA Research Institution, the National Center for Scientific Research, engineers from Cairo University, and the HIP Institute have teamed up to create minimally invasive robotic exploration devices for use in the Scan Pyramids Project. Remember the Scan Pyramids Project? Here's a quick refresher. The Scan Pyramids Project was started in October of 2015 under the authority of the Egyptian Ministry of Antiquities to utilize the, quote, most innovative technologies to probe the heart of the largest pyramids of Egypt without drilling the slightest opening. This concept, however, does actually do a little tiny bit of drilling. A small hole about 1.5 inches in diameter would be drilled into a wall or door. Then a tubular robot would be inserted into the hole that deploys an omnidirectional high-resolution camera, providing a live video feed of whatever lies on the other side. If the unexplored area looks interesting, a second robot would be pushed through the tube. This one would be a self-inflating blimp festooned with sensors. It could float around in the new area, taking photographs, and use things like laser rangefinders to map out the area without disturbing anything. The development team noted that the floating robot wouldn't be hindered by steps, rocks, or debris that would hinder a regular wheeled robot probe, and it could maneuver to unattainable vantage points due to its floating ability. When its scanning mission is complete, the blimp would return to the hole in the wall, deflating after docking, and then be ready for easy retrieval. Right now, the blimp only exists as a few conceptual schematics and videos. There is currently no concrete plan to send this robot in any particular monument, said project leader Jean-Baptiste Moret. But it is the right time to imagine, develop, and validate the technologies that are needed to explore heritage buildings. I think they're onto something here. Minimally invasive floating archaeological probes. Perfect for identifying which chamber the ancient evil alien god Sutek is sleeping in without accidentally reviving him, bringing his reign of death and destruction to all human life. Ah! Speaking of Egypt, everyone will learn how to make papyrus? Well, you're in luck. I know somewhere where you can, and it's called Pulp & Deckel. Pulp & Deckel supports this show and is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio. Pulp & Deckel's mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products, and working with artists in creating all styles of art through the medium of papermaking. Browse a rotating selection of papermaking workshops, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the ancient art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckel.com. Hey, mention all of your beer and talk, and I might give you something special. Did you by any chance get a virtual assistant smart speaker as a gift over the holidays? Pretty cool and questionably useful, right? What would you say if I told you that there's a new competitor to Google, Amazon, and Microsoft's offerings? Her name is Lauren, and she's an actual flesh and blood human being. Hyperallergic spoke with artist Lauren McCarthy about her virtual assistant surveillance project called Lauren. She solicits invitations from the public to have her enter their home and wire it for 24/7 surveillance. After collecting some information from applicants, such as why they'd like to be watched and what's unique about their home, Lauren makes her selections and shows up at the applicants' homes, ready to be their, quote, human intelligent smart home assistant for 3 days. She installs cameras, microphones, and other remote assist devices to control things like locks and lights, and then remotely, Lauren watches and listens to everything you do, ready to fulfill requests one would normally ask the other virtual assistants, like give the weather forecast and start and stop timers. The point of this is to explore the disjointed relationship modern society has with digital surveillance. People seem to be very adamant about not being recorded, but don't seem to be bothered a bit about being recorded in their own home by a fancy technological gizmo. One that is pushing ideas from developers in Silicon Valley, ideas that these outside interests feel are of use to the general public. The interview itself is quite interesting. It broaches topics such as voyeurism and psychology, and I recommend reading it at Hyperallergic if you want further insight. And you can also check out the project page at getlauren.com. That is GETLAUREN.com. Hey, if you can make it into the future, you're probably rich. So you'll be very interested to know that there will be a unique new luxury hotel available to you for $40 million a week. I'm sure you could just find it in between the cushions of your lion fur and elephant ivory sofa. Did I mention the hotel will be in space? Engadget reports via Popular Mechanics that Russian space corporation Roscosmos plans to build a luxury hotel module that attaches to the International Space Station. Russian space contractor RKK Energia came up with the strategy of offering rooms for $40 million a week, and also offer an extended stay option that comes with supervised spacewalk opportunities for an additional $20 million to help fund construction of the module itself. RKK Energia had originally planned to build two modules for the ISS, a science and power module called the NEM-1, and a second NEM module, but the Russian government only funded the first module. By making the second module a very exclusive, rich people-only destination, they can totally afford to construct the second module for a mere $279 to $446 million. Why they felt the need to build the second module at all is beyond me, unless it's simply to provide a new revenue stream. Which I'm sure it will. The tourist module will look an awful lot like the NEM-1 module from the outside, and will have the luxurious accommodations of 4 sleeping quarters around 2 cubic meters in size each, with a 9-inch porthole-style window looking out at space, 2, quote, medical and hygiene stations, and a lounge area with a 16-inch window. RKK Energia hopes to fill 2 seats that will be left vacant on Soyuz capsules when NASA stops using them to ferry their astronauts to the ISS with rich tourists. RKK just needs to find 12 potential guests who would prepay $4 million up front to kickstart construction of the hotel, and they plan for the hotel to have paid for its own construction within 7 years of operation. Popular Mechanics notes that currently the ISS will be decommissioned in 2028, and it will take 5 years to build the space hotel module. If you do the math, you can see what the problem is there. So I don't see how they could possibly make a profit unless they ask the guests to double bunk. Space Hotel! To close out this first episode of the new year, I want to end on some positive stories. We've all had a rough year, so let's go into this one smiling and full of hope and joy and happiness. On Xmas Day, my wife and I and some close friends gathered around and watched Peter Capaldi portray the Doctor for the last time on Doctor Who. The series changes its lead actor about every 2 to 3 years, but you really get invested in each actor's portrayals of the wandering Time Lord that just wants to be kind to others, and it's a tough every time seeing them go and be replaced by a stranger. This weighed heavily on 9-year-old fan David, who was, quote, dreading the moment when the Doctor he loved would change and disappear forever, according to his father, Brian McGilloway. He was so upset he wrote a letter that somehow made its way to Peter Capaldi himself. Now, Capaldi is an actual Doctor Who fan. He had grown up watching the series and truly understands what makes it so appealing to so many people. Capaldi wrote a letter back to David that is so beautiful it brings a tear to my eye just thinking about it. I shall attempt to read it to you here. Dear David, I hope you are having a very merry Xmas. Xmas is always good fun. Well, not always. Not every single second. Regenerating is not completely good fun, and it usually happens about Xmas time. But you know what? Even though it can be a bit icky, like really bad blue, it has always, always turned out good for Doctor Who. The new Doctor always becomes your favorite, and the one that goes... Well, he never really goes. He is always there, somewhere in time and space, and if you think about him hard enough, you'll see him. And he'll see you. It's like the Doctor says, everything ends and it's always sad, but everything begins again and that's always happy. Be happy. So, have a brilliant Xmas, a happy new year, and a wonderful life. I'm sure you will. All the best, Peter Capaldi. Doctor? I'm not crying. You're crying. And now for the animal story. Well, it's more of an anecdote, but it's sweet. New Scientist reports that after crows fight, they touch and preen each other to make up. This observation was made during research on carrion crows at that fantastic crow research facility, the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology in Germany. Miriam Sima and her colleagues studied groups of crows that were unfamiliar to each other. Crow strangers! They wanted to see how they would react to fights among crows who didn't know each other too well, so they staged tense situations in an enclosure. They noticed that when food in the cage was limited, the crows fought more than when it was abundant. During the food shortages, crow altercations ensued, some more violent than others. When the crows were only mildly aggressive towards each other, when the food was gone, the aggressor would seek out their victim and sit close by, touching and, in some cases, preening their feathers, seemingly in an attempt to apologize for their behavior. If the fight was violent, the aggressors kept a wide berth from the victim, and the victims would often seek out reassurance, preening, from a crow that wasn't involved in the fight. This is the first study in which corvids were observed engaging in what's called flexible reconciliations and third-party consolation. And you know what? If crows can fight and then apologize and make up, maybe we humans can learn that as well. Everyone, I produce this show as a free gift for all mankind. However, I have a proposition for you. If you get value or entertainment from the show, maybe you would like to support me? I have some options for you. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail matches, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know! Email me at gary@pulpanddeckle.com. That is GARY@PULPANDDECKLE.com. Rates are reasonable. And if you could you rate and review this show on iTunes? The more reviews and ratings I have at has, the more its discoverability will go up when people look for tech podcasts that might have beer involved. And you can also support the show directly with money. If you enjoy my show each week, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabitradio. Go to patreon.com/ihabitradio and become my patron. You'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. And those guys are awesome. You want to be awesome, right? Well, there you go. First new show of 2018. Reflecting back on the previous year, I'm actually pretty pleased with myself for figuring out a lot of interesting things making this podcast for another complete year. And I look forward to continuing to do it, as long as you keep coming back and listen. Yeah? Yeah? Anyway, It's time for me to go. There's still a lot of Sammy Claus needing my wife's help in drinking this one. 14% ABV. Yikes. Anyway, please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and the new Doctor Who about the show, and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to gary@pulpandtackle.com, on the Twitters and Instagram at iHabitRadio, or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHabitRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!